The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and other musicians, uncover their life stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, then stick around. You're in the right place. If you're enjoying this show and you'd like to support it, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/support. And for information on advertising, visit everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. Hey, everybody, this is Craig Garber. Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar. And today we are going to give love to the rhythm section. I'm with one of the coolest, greatest drummers in the history of rock and roll. I'm with Ian Paice from Deep Purple. It's truly an honor and a privilege to have him on the show with me. I feel like I'm 15. I just want to say a couple of thank yous. Tommy Alderson, thank you very much, man. When we met standing online there at NAMM, you said that you'd be able to speak to Ian, and you did. And I thank you so much for hooking us up. And also Natalie Schmidt at the label, who's listening in, and Kat Rallis for putting this all together. If you don't know Ian, I'm really sorry. I'm going to give you a 2-second background. He's the last original remaining member of Deep Purple, still active in the band today. He founded Deep Purple with singer Rod Evans and Richie Blackmore in March of 1968. Over the last 52 years, Deep Purple's released 21 studio and 40 live records, most of which I seem to have, and they're all killer. Ian's also played and toured with Whitesnake, Gary Moore, Pace Ashton Lord, and on projects with Paul McCartney, George Harrison, and others. He also co-wrote many of Deep Purple's tracks, including Child in Time, Highway Star, Lazy, Smoke on the Water, Woman from Tokyo, and others, and he's a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Man, thank you so much for coming on this show. I literally feel like I'm 15. So
it's amazing. I've got time to do it after you read all that stuff. Right?
All right. Take me back. Tell me about Georgie and the Ravons and Maze, because you're like 16, no?
Well, I joined my first band when I was 15, little local band, and that was Georgie and the Ravons, yeah. Georgie was a little Scottish guy, named George Adams, and he had a great voice, but say vertically challenged. he was the same width as he was tall.
Oh yeah.
but he had a great voice. But we just used to play in pubs. You know, we'd end up with enough money in the jar at the end of the night to buy a couple of pints of beer each. We thought we'd had a great night.
Right.
And it was a good little local band for considering what it was, you know, and I was with them for a couple of years. You do those little gigs and occasionally you meet up with another band and you meet up with them 3 or 4 times because you're sort of on the same circuit and they're a bit further along the road than you are. And this band called the MI5 at the time, their drummer was leaving and they sort of found how to get word to me and asked if I would like to make that move from my first little semi-pro band to become professional, you know. So that was pretty traumatic. It's always leaving your first outfit, you know, because they're the first adult social circle you ever have. You know, you'd being treated like an adult for the first time, and you know, you sink or swim under your own power. And so that was a break, but I knew I had to make that move to see where it would go. And so that was the period of Georgie and the Ravons. But Georgie was a great guy, but the highlight of the whole show was where at the end of the night he could eat fire. He was like a fire eater. And we, you know, all the way through the music where we were playing covers of Tamla Motown and Beatles and stuff, you know, we get a Little River. As soon as he had the fire, they brought the house down. That was the biggest thing, of the night. So anyway, I moved on and joined the MI5, which was with Rod Evans as a singer in the band, which is where we hooked up. And we used to have a trick in those days. You know, you could only do so many venues before the promoters said, oh, we've seen them. We want somebody new. So after about a year, you just change the name. So the MI5 became the Maze.
Oh, okay.
And we managed to do all the same shows, all the same gigs again. And the promoters were never quite sure. They, oh, I think I've seen you somewhere before.
That's great.
So that's how we kept working.
That's really cool. So you always knew you were going to be a musician early on.
I don't even think you know. I think I wanted to be. As soon as I realized I could actually understand why a drum kit worked, and I found the basics very simple, I really didn't want to be anything else. Did I think I could be? It's only when I did get that offer to become professional that I thought, well, I must be doing something right. Because, I mean, I was in that first band for 2 years, and I was in the next band, the MI5 stroke Maze, for 2 years, and then 4 years after I started to play, I'm in Deep Purple. So I must have been doing something that got me noticed without even thinking about it. And at that point, you think, well, yeah, this is it. This is what I'm going to do. I obviously can do it, and I don't want to do anything else.
Yeah. I'm just amazed. This is so, I mean, who's in a band for 52 years, man? That's pretty amazing.
Mick Jagger.
I don't mean literally who's in a band, you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't happen, man. It's just like,
no.
Amazing.
Well, when we formed Purple, I mean, if you got 5 years at that period of time, that was miraculous.
Yeah.
You know, most bands, 2-3 years, they were gone. They'd either implode, and we know all about that, or they just lost interest. It is. It's pretty incredible. It's been bumpy. You know, we've had situations where you wake up in the morning, you've got a band, and in the afternoon, you haven't got a band.
Yeah.
Somebody's left or somebody's been fired, and you go, how did that happen? Yeah. In my own defense, I never really fired anybody. I was sort of caught up in it. I never saw the point in rocking a boat that was smoothly sailing along the sea.
Right.
But that's the way it works sometimes. But we're still here, we're still kicking, and we're still having fun, man. If you don't have fun, you can't do this. Because there's a lot of crap attached to the fun.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of travel which can go horribly wrong. There's a lot of places you have to stay that you probably wouldn't like to stay, even at the top end of the game. The things really? Things yeah. do get screwy sometimes, and you have to say, okay, that's part of it, that's part of what I do. But for that 1.5-2 hours a night you're on stage, it puts all this stuff, other stuff, away. You don't worry about it. That's what makes it work, you know.
That's awesome, man.
Because you said earlier on you felt like a 15-year-old kid again. Well, that's what, when I get on stage every night, I'm that 15-year-old kid again who started banging drums. That's my relief from reality. You know, I can go out and I'm untouchable on stage. I can't be got on a telephone. I can't be asked to do anything else. That's what I do for 2 hours. And it's all about me and my four buddies. And we're protected. That's it. We're on stage for 2 hours. And that's where it's at.
That is so cool to hear that your passion is the same today as it was 52 or 58 years ago, whenever you started playing music.
Well, it's fun, man. When you're a kid, you start playing an instrument, maybe not every instrument. You know, I'm sure there's lots of little Johnnies out there whose mother and father said, you're going to play the violin. And you go, I don't want to play the violin. With the drummer, that's never been the case. If somebody becomes a drummer, it's because they want to be one. You know, so the fact that you're still doing it, you know, towards the latter half of your life means you must enjoy it.
Yeah.
Or else you'd have gone off and done something else. Yeah.
You guys had a certain, you know, you had that thing since day one, early on, first record, second record. I was curious, were there any challenges, though, or what were the challenges early on as far as getting the band launched?
Well, we were fortunate and unfortunate at the same time. We had three guys who were all bored with their jobs. They wanted to get out of their regular jobs and get into show business. They were going to be managers, and they had money. So these three guys, one was dealing in frozen food. One was and stolen goods. Apparently later on we found, as he spent a few years at Her Majesty's pleasure. And one was in the rag trade, and one was in the advertising industry. And they hooked up with, I can't remember, it might have been John Lord, it might have been Richie. No, it was through Chris Curtis of The Searchers.
Okay.
Chris was trying to put a new band together, and he somehow got together with these three guys who wanted to become the next megastar managers of the show business industry. And they put money up to get people together, i.e. they got Richie in, they got John in, and eventually they got Rod and myself in via Richie. So we had backing. So we could take time to put stuff together. Even though we weren't writing our own songs at the time, we could take time to use other people's material and try and put a different slant on it. We slowly started to write our own stuff, but it was never a strength of that first lineup. But we had a chance because we didn't have to be on the road earning our coin from the first day. We had a guaranteed wage every week till we could live. And we took that first two or three months and found the band, you know, that was it. So we had an advantage. And then, of course, we had the first record. Well, again, that was just serendipity, good luck. There was a new company in the States called Tetragrammaton, which was a Campbell Silver Cosby Corporation, Bill Cosby, Bruce Campbell, Roy Silver. And they were starting a record company, and they wanted an English band, a new English band. And so just the positioning of people and the timing, we were the guys. And of course, we made the first record, Shades of Deep Purple, which made in 2 afternoons, did 4 tracks a day. And Hush became the hit it was. And it sort of took off from there. Everything in this industry, nearly everything, is about timing and luck. You know, I've always said you can make the best record ever in the world at the wrong time and it'll just disappear. You make an average record at the right time and you can have a mega hit. There's no logic. There's no right or wrong about it. It's just the way it works.
Sure. You guys did both, though. I mean, you had great records there, and they were in the right time, which is, you know, even better.
You know? Well, I put it down to even more serendipity than that. You know, I was born in the right country at the right time.
Yeah.
You know, I've always said if I had been born in Bulgaria at exactly the same moment in the same year, my life would have been totally different.
Yes.
You know, so there is, just from the accident of birth, there is a great deal of, you know, good luck involved in it.
For sure, man. I want to ask you about, in 99, you did a record with Sir Paul, mm-hmm. Run Devil Run, and that was his first record after Linda had passed.
Yeah.
Had a bunch of guests on there, including yourself and David Gilmour. I was curious what that experience was like, and did you also participate in the Cavern Club performance of that record?
Yeah. Well, I knew George very, very well. His house is 2.5 miles from mine, and our sons grew up together. We, you know, knew each other till he left us. And I'd met Ringo a long time ago, but I never met John, and I never met Paul. But Paul had been wanting to do a record of rock and roll tunes that turned him on when he was a kid. And Linda said, well, you should do it. And he never got round to doing it. And after she died and he took time away from everything, he decided he was going to do it. And he didn't know who was going to be on the record. So he had a producer. And when it came down to choosing a drummer, because all the people he'd normally use in the States, that just wasn't possible. So producer's name was Chris. I can't remember his name now. But he'd seen me play, and he suggested to Paul that I was playing okay. Maybe we should give me a chance, you know. And it was duly booked a week at Abbey Road. Start on a Monday, finish on a Friday, see what we get done. Great fun. I met him. He's a smashing guy. You know, considering who he is and what he is, he's really a very nice fella. But I know, had I been crap on the Monday, I wouldn't have been there Tuesday.
Yeah, bottom line, yes, of course.
Oh, yeah. But it worked out okay, and we had a great deal of fun. And we did a couple of live performances, sometimes for charities and sometimes, as you say, the Cavern Club. And Dave Gilmore and I have been sort of loose friends for a long time. And so that wasn't a problem. And the other guitarist, Mickey Green, who is a legend in Britain from Johnny Kidd and the Pirates, and which is one of the guys we all knew, you know. And then Pete Wingfield, who was a wonderful session piano player. So it was a great little band. We had a great deal of fun for the short time we were together. And it's a nice thing to have on your CV that you did something with a Beatle.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. What amazing of Beatle, Deep Purple, and the Pink Floyd. I mean, it's like the British triumvirate, man. Doesn't get any
Well,
better.
When you're Paul McCartney, you can do that.
You play with Gary Moore. He's one of my all-time favorite guitarists. I was curious, how did you guys wind up connecting, and can you share maybe a cool or funny story about working with him?
Well, Gary was needing to do some new records, and there weren't many people sitting around on their asses doing nothing at the time, and I wasn't in a band at that time. And so his management got word to me, said, you know, make a record with Gary. And I said, sure, you know, just we can set the time, we'll do it. And we had fun in the studio. And they asked me if I would like to do some live stuff. So I said, sure. And we had a really nice time together. We made two or three nice records and very enjoyable. Gary was... on the face of it, quite a complex character, but underneath it, he wasn't. He was quite a sweet guy. But you had to get through that that facade.
Yeah.
You know? I only ever had one problem with Gary, and then he would rehearse things to death, you know. By the time you hit the stage the first time, you felt you'd been on the road for a month. You know, you just rehearse and rehearse and rehearse. At one point I said, look, yeah, we ain't going to get any better, you know. He said, that's, you know, we've done it like 12 times now, every day for 2 weeks. You know, it's not going to get, it's good, it's perfect. I go, oh, no, man, we've got to try one more time, you know. It was in his psyche, you know, just get, and that was the only thing that used to drive me nuts about him. But on stage, I mean, just superb player.
Incredible.
You know? And then, of course, you know, he found that he could sing, which was, you know, another great string to his bow. And the weird thing is, once he made the big blues record and had the big hit, people suddenly started, who didn't know his previous work, suddenly Gary was a blues player. And Gary didn't want to be a blues player. It's something he enjoyed. And he did it as a bit of fun. But it became mega for him. And then he couldn't get out of it. And he, you know, that's where he tried working with Jack Bruce and Ginger Baker to do a rocky thing. Just sank, disappeared. No, you're a blues player. That's a public perception of him. And once that happened, he couldn't get out of it. It's the strangest thing.
Interesting. Yeah. I never knew that. I thought so that was a little detour. He wanted to get back to doing his rock stuff.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Rock and sort of rocky fusion stuff.
Yeah.
He had all the technique in the world. You know, yeah, but he sort of painted himself into his own very successful corner.
Wow. I love that record, by the way, the three you made, but and also the one you just mentioned, the Beck, Bruce Baker Moore. That was a great record.
Yeah, good stuff, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, anybody who's that good can actually play anything. They won't play everything as well as everything else, but they can play anything. You know, that's just the nature of being good.
Yeah. Mm. So I've heard... You played in some pretty extreme weather conditions. 13,000 feet elevation in Bolivia, also in a typhoon and on top of a snow-covered mountain. Maybe talk about those gigs.
Well, playing in Bolivia is tough. You know, I think if you're a lounge trio playing waltzes and quick steps, it's not too difficult. But when you're playing hard rock and roll and you have a third the oxygen available, you know, it's taxing. And you know, we each had oxygen bottles to take a hit between songs, because otherwise you just pass out. I mean, you got all these locals there just chewing coca leaves to stay alive, you know, and you're expected to go blast through a 2-hour rock and roll set. It was a little tough. The blizzard. Well, we did this one show, and I can't remember, it was either Russia or Ukraine or somewhere like that, somewhere in the East Europe, one of those two. And it was like September, so it should have been okay. But this massive snowstorm came over. and to compound it, we'd flown in on a Russian jet, which half the crew refused to get on. The bits hanging off it, and I think we had two of the back line and the wardrobe girl, who was braver than the rest of them. She said, "I'll go." And so we had virtually no crew. We had very nice clean clothes, of course. And we basically had to set up the gear ourselves. I was going, my guy went, but I know Steve Morse was setting his own gear up because his guy at the time wouldn't go. He wouldn't get on a plane, so wow. I'm not doing that. And then this blizzard came across, and instead of it being like, you know, should have been like mid-60s Fahrenheit at that time of night, it was minus 20. I mean, holy, it was just unbelievable. Crap. I mean, Steve was just rubbing his fingers trying to keep them flexible. Oh, but we did the show and got the hell out of there. So we have played in some very strange places, yeah. Hey, the gig comes along, you accept it. You don't know what's going to happen on the night. But once you've done it, you get the show done.
Right.
Just get it done. No matter what happens, get it done so there's nothing to worry about. It's history. Gone. Bye-bye. Yeah.
So where'd you get that work ethic from? Because you've always had that, obviously.
I wouldn't say it's like the old showbiz thing of the show must go on, because I don't actually believe that. There's times when you should pull the show and say, hey, it's not going to work, you know. But I think if you can, you should. Because it's not just you. You may have 7, 8, 10, 15,000 people who've traveled a long way, spent a lot of money, and to make them go home again and have to do it all over again or try and get their money back, it's just easier to do the show. Get it done. Everybody's happy. Everybody knows it won't be perfect. But if you do that and you make that effort, nearly everybody in an audience will give you a break on it and say, look, we enjoyed it. We came all this way and we did the show and it was fine. But when if you have to cancel, you do, but try not to. So it's not really a work ethic. It's just good sound business.
Yeah.
And it's better for the audience that they've got closure on it too.
Yeah. You
know, they put their money up. They've had their fun.
That's a good word, and closure.
You move on. You know, That's it.
So tough question. Really tough. Of all the musical experiences you've had over the last 50 plus years, give me your knee jerk reaction to the top three.
I think some of the most traumatic things that can happen are out of your control. I remember we were playing in Jakarta in the mid-70s when Tommy Bolin was in the band. And we lost one of our security guys, murdered, basically, you know, thrown down an elevator shaft.
Holy
don't know where the elevator was, but it wasn't where it should have been.
Wow.
He just, you know, late night, maybe a bit too much drink, got mixed up with the wrong couple of guys. So that's pretty traumatic. You know, you don't forget those things because they're right so close to you. That's pretty bad. Then you remember things like the Cal Jam, you know, massive show. And all with all the stuff that went on with that show, nothing to do with music, you know, keeping Richie out of the clutches of the sheriff, you know, because most big shows never run on time, you know, they're always late, but that was so brilliantly organized. He was running ahead of time. And our contract said we would be the first band to go on after sunset. That was, you know, everybody thought that'd be really safe because if it ran half an hour late, it'd be fine. We ran like an hour early or something. So Richie, God bless him, said, no, we're not going on, you know, our contract says that. And the promoter's starting to panic. He's got 300 and something thousand people there. And so he goes and gets the sheriff, and the sheriff says, you've got to go on stage. And he said, I'm not doing it. And the sheriff said, if you don't, I'm going to arrest you. Well, that's really going to help, isn't it?
Yeah, right. That'll get it done.
Yeah. So Richie, I'm not doing it. So the sheriff went off to get some. And then we had to hide Richie. We hid him until the sun was just going down. We got him on stage. And that was fine and dandy. But, of course, then all the explosions, the thing we got planned on stage, that confused everybody, things blowing up. And then, of course, when we'd finished, we got to get Richie off stage without the sheriff finding him. So as far as I remember it, we just stuck him in a big flight case, moved it off stage, and got him to a helicopter and got him out of Dodge, man. Him out of the county.
Man, you couldn't.
I remember more of that than I do about the gig. The only way I remember the gig is because I've seen the video afterwards. Yeah. And that explosion was so big. My roadie's behind me, and once it goes kaboom, you see him jumping with laughter because it blew my glasses off. It was so powerful. I'm like 30 feet away from it, and my spectacles just blew away. It was so strong. Well, that way they went.
Holy cow.
Well, nobody really had any idea about how much gasoline was needed to make it work. So is that enough? No, we'll put a bit more in. That look all right? Nah, a bit more should be better. So from the time finished, they created a bomb. Well, you see, Richie takes off like he's Superman, you know. So, wow. Those sort of things you do remember, yeah.
Wow.
Hey, it's only rock and roll, man.
do you have a favorite song that you co-wrote or a favorite song to play?
I don't look at it that way. I get very, very insular about it. Because when you do this, you're recording, you know. So I look at tracks where I think I've done the best job I could. And if I can look back after 10 years and say, I couldn't have done it better. I'm really proud of those things. They're the tracks that I think about. I don't even think about the composition. I think about the playing. Did I get it right? Could I have done it better? Some tracks I look at and say, yeah, I wish I hadn't done that. I should have done this. I could have done it better. But, you know, and you just accept that that's the nature of making a lot of music. You're not always going to get it right. But those tracks where I knew I did a really good drum part, and a drum part that was me, nobody else, you know, sort of as much as it can be for a drummer, recognizable as me, they're the ones that keep it all right in my head, nothing else.
Thank you. That's a great answer for that, man. Favorite musicians you've enjoyed playing with outside of other members of Deep Purple?
Well, obviously, Paul, because forget the fact that he's a great singer and a great composer. What a bass player. Man, it's just every Beatles record feels great. And him and Ringo together. It's just like one mind. But with Paul, I put it into this very simple thing. If a bass player plays two to the bar, you know, dum, dum, usually that's country. It feels like country.
Yes.
When Paul plays it, it's rock and roll. There's that split second of timing difference, which makes it hard and makes it swing. It doesn't make it corny and soft. And he's just got that. It's just, you don't teach that. You just know it. And so playing with him, even with the simplest thing, just the swing inside it, you just can't help but make it work with him. That was good. Same thing when I played with one of your great guys, Leland Sklar. I did a competition thing in Germany with him. It was great fun. We played a couple of tracks together. And Lee's got a saying, if you slightly lose the tempo a bit, if you just push a bit, you just get this sort of, the head just turns towards you. Oh, shoot, pull it back.
Oh, he's keeping his...
He's like a rock, man. He just holds it for you. And if you just slip, he's just give you this little look and you go, oh, I've been a bad boy.
Wow.
Great playing with Lee. I love him to death. Fabulous guy. I mean, it's hard. There's so many guys I have played with over the years, and whether they've been for a long time or just a jam on a night, you know, it's hard to remember them all. I mean, there's a couple of guys I'd never got to play with. One was Jimi Hendrix.
Mm, yeah.
We should have done. We were Carmine Appice and I, great pal of mine. We were in a club in New York, John Paul's Scene Club on 48th Street, something like that. And Hendrix turned up. Everybody was in New York for just, you know, chance. And he was going to have a jam. And so Carmine said, look, I'll jump on first, play a couple of songs, and you jump on after. Never. Yeah. Well, Carmine got up, but he never got off. He stayed there all night long. I mean, I would say neither one of us were actually sober.
Right.
So I don't blame him for forgetting. You know, right. He was having a great time. So that was the only chance I really did have to maybe have a play with Jim, but I never did it. So that's something I'm missing, you know.
Playing with Hendrix, yeah. Tell me, it's a tough question, happiest moment or happiest time in your life?
Well, you mean music related or just life related?
Whatever you'd like.
Yeah, well, it's nothing to do with music. I mean, the music's been good to me and hopefully will be till I can't do it anymore. Corny, but birth of my first child, my son.
That's awesome.
You know, all of a sudden, reality kicks you in the face and it's pretty amazing. And you realize in that one moment, your whole life has changed. It's not about you anymore. It's not even about your partner. It's about that little thing wailing and shitting in your arms, you know. And it just changes, and you become a different person. Or if you should become a different person, because it's bigger than you then.
Yeah.
So that's the massive thing. When it comes to the business, I just say thank you every morning.
Yeah.
It's been good to me and it continues to be good to me. And it looks after me and my family. And I'll never treat it with disrespect. I'll always understand that it can disappear in an instant. For two reasons. I could lose the ability to play, or I could treat it with contempt and the audience say, I'm not going to watch you anymore. So, no, I value it greatly. And I will always do so, you know.
Have you always been like that?
I think it's in your nature. I think a lot of it's also the way you're brought up, what you get from your parents. I came from a solid family. You know, mum and dad stayed together the whole life. There wasn't a second mum or a second dad or any of that sort of stuff. I think that's a that's a great foundation for any child to know that it's secure. I know that life now for a lot of people is demanding. And sometimes two people can't stay together forever. But I think when you have kids, you really have to put your feelings on the back burner and make it work for them, because they're the ones that eventually suffer, not you.
Yeah.
Or your partner. You find other things. You find another partner. You change. You change. You do something else. Kids get hurt. No matter what people think, kids get hurt. And once you've got those, once you've got your immortality in front of you, I say, it's not about you anymore. It's about them.
Thanks, man. That was really cool. Who's had the biggest influence on you musically and maybe also personally?
Well, the influence has changed. I mean, when I was a kid, all I really ever heard in my house was my father's music, which was all big band swing, and because he was a piano player. And the great pianist, you know, Oscar Peterson, and before that, Earl Hines, and you could go on, you know. So I heard that music. So that was my biggest influence, even though it was not music I was going to play. So when I did start playing, all those feels, all those swingy things.
That's where your swing comes from, man.
I couldn't translate it any other way.
That's
the way I heard it. So I wasn't hearing rock and roll, you know. I mean, what I grew to learn rock and roll later, you know, And I still, when I want something new, I go and find something really old. I'm trying to find something interesting. I'll probably go back to, I always go back and try and listen to every Little Richard track I can and find out what Earl Palmer was doing on the kit, or what, you know, Elvis's guy was doing. If you find something that's so old, it becomes new because everybody else has forgotten about it. Yeah. And then you just try and find a way of updating it, you know? So, though, yeah, I learned that later. But the initial thing when I started to play in a little rock and roll band, it would have a swing to it. I couldn't help it.
That makes so much sense now, man, that you're saying that. Because you're so distinct, you know, your style is so, you always had that swing no matter what you're playing.
Well, I call it big band rock and roll. that's what it is.
That's right on.
And I say I have no choice. Occasionally we'll write a piece of music which is so straight ahead and simple, eights. I have to be physically told, don't swing it. Because sometimes things are not meant to. Some things are. If you imagine when ZZ Top came out with the Eliminator album, right. It had to be like that. Had anything swung in it, it would have messed it up completely.
Right.
You know, it was metronomically controlled music. But because of that, and because it's so perfect, it works. Now, if Frank had started bouncing around inside it, it wouldn't have been the same record.
No, not at all.
So I have to be reminded occasionally, hey, straight eight. Don't bounce. You know. Yeah.
Your dad played professionally? That was what his career was?
Pre-war, yeah. Pre-war.
Wow.
And then, like everybody, got caught up in that madness between 39 and 45.
Yeah.
And I have an older brother. He was born in 38, 10 years before me. And, of course, when the craziness finished and my father came home, he had a 6-7-year-old son. So reality bit him in the ass and he had to get a real job.
Yeah.
So from that point on, he played semi-professionally.
Sure.
You know. And my first gigs were with him playing waltzes and quick sets. Occasionally his drummer wouldn't be able to do it. Once I got the point when I was 15, he bought me my first drum kit. Occasionally I would be able to sit in and play his quick steps and foxtrots and waltzes. That's pretty cool. You know, I'd work with him for 3 hours on a Saturday night and earn the same amount of money as I got for 3 days at work. Yeah, this is all right. I could do that. Yeah. I'm not doing a lot of money here. I'm talking about $8 or something, but hey, yeah, I was only earning about $12 a week. So, you know, it was a little light went in on my head. This ain't so bad, you know.
Plus, it must have been cool playing with your dad. That had to be a good experience.
Oh, it was fun playing with him, of course. Cool is not what you talk about when you're playing waltzes and quick steps.
Yeah, I guess.
It was funny, you know, because Dad did like a drink, and I was like 15 and have to be driving him home at night because he couldn't. And we had this big old, in Britain, big old Ford. It would have been a tiny car in the States at the time, but in Britain it was a big car. And I was not I'm not a big guy now, but I was quite small at that age. And I could just about see over the steering wheel to drive the 5 miles home, hoping there weren't any police cars on the way.
Oh, my God. Yeah. And those roads are
so
not easy.
I remember
easy.
That more than anything else. When learning to drive, mostly on the road and half the time in a field.
And how about personally? Who's been the biggest influence on you?
I can't pick one guy because they've appeared on my radar throughout my career. Once I joined a band, the two guys that I listened to were Ringo and Bobby Elliott from the Hollies. Bobby, because he was better than anybody else playing that style of music. He had a nicer sound. He had clever little fills that nobody else was doing. And Ringo, because it just felt so great. So they were the two when I started playing rock and roll that I always looked to, you know. Ringo, later on, when he started becoming so inventive, when they moved away from the first three or four simple rock and roll tunes and we started getting into Revolver and everything that came after that, where the drum patterns suddenly became pieces of music in their own right. That also showed. I know there's a lot of George Martin creativity there and a lot of input from Paul, but Ringo did it. you know, and you listen to everything he did, and it's just so brilliant, you know. And it doesn't have to be Buddy Rich floating around a kit 400 miles an hour. It has to be music. And when you listen to Ringo from the very, it's just music, man. Those drums are playing music, and that in itself is magic. Makes it different.
Well, I think
he's not just going 1, 2, 3, 4. He's playing music.
And I'm not blowing smoke, but I think your drumming is like that very much. So
I hope so.
It's very.
I mean, the tracks I've done where I think I didn't like the track in the first place, but I'm involved in it, so I do the best job I can. And some of those tracks, I think somebody else could have done them better because I wasn't really interested. But there are other tracks where, it's okay. I've done some cool stuff.
It's okay. I like that. But also, you know, you have a catalog this big. Statistically, it's impossible to feel good about all. I mean, it's just not possible, you know?
Well, you know, you even when you're involved in the writing of songs, when you are a cooperative, sometimes the creation you have here may be something that you're really not in love with.
Sure.
But the other guys are.
Right.
So, you bite the bullet and you say, I'm going to do the best thing I can on it. But if your heart's not in it, it'll only be so good. When it's part of you, then you can give everything. You know, it's inside you. When it's not inside you, then you're just doing a job. You just hope you do it as good as you can. That's all.
Can you knee-jerk reaction to what are the purple songs that are most, or just that you think of most part of you that are songs like that?
There's some very obvious ones. Burn is very obvious because it was totally unique in the fact that there's a drum solo underneath every verse. I mean, that's pretty different. Some of the early tracks are not at the front of people's thought processes, but they're things that I hear them. I thought that was really good. And Living Wreck on the In Rock record, I think that's a lovely drum track. It's musical. It moves around inside this very simple formulated riff. I like that. On the Burn, I think Sail Away, which is quite a funky track that Richie came up with a very slinky riff to. I love the drumming on that too. I mean, I could probably pick out 20 where I go, yeah, that's good. The Battle Rages On, the actual track itself. I remember recording it. We were getting nowhere. We must have been, I'd gone about take 20 and it just wasn't working. And we kept soldiering on. I would do one more. And a little light went on. And the drum part changed completely. And all of a sudden it was working. We listened back to the last, that's it. Let's go and do another one. Back, the light went off. It was back like it was before. For that 5 minutes, whatever the track is, I just hit it. And then I couldn't do it again. So that became the master. It was good enough.
Right. You
know, but I couldn't get, that was it. Just, you know, somebody said, here's the magic. Now the magic stops.
Funny how that happens, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's very strange, and it you'd like to think it's just inside you, but sometimes it's just that blend of what the other guys are doing too, and it just may be the inflection of a note or something one of the top line guys did, and it just makes you do something different, and then you found it. And if that doesn't happen, then it goes away again. You can't remember what the hell it was you did, even when you listen back, can't get it. It was just that moment when you get it.
But that's what you captured, and that was the master, you said, though.
Yeah, that's it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Have you had hobbies or interests outside of music over the years?
When I was a younger man, I did enjoy playing some sports. I mean, I enjoyed what you call soccer.
Sure. Football.
And I love the game you have no knowledge of called cricket.
Right, I have no knowledge of that.
Exactly, yeah. 360-degree baseball, that's what it is. I love deep-sea fishing.
Yeah.
But not for trophies. If I go out hunting, I'm going to eat the bastard.
Yeah. You know,
if I catch something, I eat it.
I love fishing. Where do you what do you go for?
Well, when I was in the States and I had time, I would charter a big boat down in Key Biscayne and just go out into Gulf Stream and catch anything. Forget all those big monsters. It lives in the ocean, should stay there. But if I can catch something, 2 foot long that I can stick on a grill, I'll catch a bunch of those.
Yeah, man.
I mean, we took one charter out for a day. We caught so many, my. The $1,000 charter cost me $50 because I said, you can keep all the fish. And he was on there selling all the restaurants again, fresh money. And that was great deal of fun. I mean, I had a couple of kids on the boat with me, and they were just pulling in fishing one after another. It was a great day,
Yeah.
So I enjoy that. I have a house down in the Mediterranean, which is tough fishing because it's overfished. But it's still, we get a nice smooth day there when the sea's like glass. You can have some fun out there. You go a couple of miles offshore, just where the shelf is, and you never know what you're going to. You could hit like a small tuna, or you could hit a small barracuda. Yeah, just stuff. But you can eat them.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I've gone.
I enjoy that. And if you don't catch anything, you got a couple of beers, the sun's shining. Hey, it's still a good day.
It's a good day, man. Yeah. I've gone fishing down in the Keys there for mahi-mahi. It's a good day when you're hitting like that, man.
Oh, yeah. Well, you just keep one in the water and keep bringing them. You just keep following. You just keep pulling them in, yeah. Yeah.
That's cool, man. Tell me a specific experience that maybe changed the way you think about things or maybe even changed your life.
I think it's – the things are really personal when – you realize your health is so fragile. It can change in an instant, and something you never really thought about. About 4 years ago now, maybe getting on for five, where I was on tour in Europe. We were in Stockholm. And I remember going to bed, feeling just a bit very tired. Oh, well, I'm tired, When I woke up in the morning, my right arm wouldn't do anything. I couldn't. It just wouldn't. I could lift the arm, but my fingers wouldn't do anything. And of course, the knowledge we have now, I've had a stroke. Looked at my face and that was all right. That wasn't. So I got in touch with the roadie, the tour manager, and luckily we were in a very good hotel in a very civilized country. And they sent their in-house medic up, and he looked at me and he said, I think you've had a minor stroke. So the process started within 15 minutes, I was in an MRI scanner being checked out. Couldn't see anything, but it was obviously what it was, but it wasn't a big one. Just a little something going on here. So I stayed in the hospital for 2 days, and they put me on a drip, and they put me in a CT, CAT scanner. And they found something really, really tiny at the back here. And they still couldn't work it out. So they got a specialist there to look at it and said, whatever it was very small and very short in duration. So, but for the rest of your life, you're going to have to take some pills because basically the problem is your blood's too thick. They said, there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing to do with the lifestyle. It's just luck of the draw. You got high blood pressure, blah, 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 blah. So now I take the 4 pills a day, which is no great hardship. And I say it for that 4.5 years, I've been fine, but that brings it home to you how soon it can just, a very good friend of mine, I'm not going to say his name, but he was a guitarist in a really successful band, had a massive stroke about 5 years ago. He ain't coming back from it. He's still alive, but there's no way back, so that little warning changes your perception of everything,
Yeah.
You just go, hey, start being aware that, and these things do happen when you get a bit older, because in your head, you're still that 15-year-old kid again, but your body ain't, and so the things that you think you can do automatically, you take a second thought about, so, well, should I? Yeah, it'll be okay, or no, just step back. I mean, it pisses me off, but that's what it is.
No, I totally get that. Wow. Thank you for sharing that, man. That was, Yeah, I could see that pissing you off. It pissed me off, that's for sure.
Yeah. But yeah, when you're a drummer and then this hand won't do anything. I couldn't even comb my hair. The brush fell out my fingers. It was scary.
Yeah, it's very scary. Well, I'm glad you're okay now, man. Holy shit. Well,
4 tablets a day, man.
Wow. Just a couple more questions. You and your wife have done a lot of work raising money for cancer with Sunflower Jam. I was just wondering if you wanted to talk about that organization at all.
Well, yeah, it's Jackie's, not mine. She does all the arrangements. She does all the work together with our kids helping. My job is to kick open a few doors and get through to people and ask them if they'd like to help, because I can. And obviously, when it's arranged, if I'm free, I'll play it there, play at the venues and back up some of these wonderful artists. But it's her baby, not mine. She deserves all the credit for it. I just help her get it going. And she made a lot of money for some great causes. And she hasn't done any for a few years now because we've been inundated with grandchildren. You know, our kids are all producing their own little kids, so she's the happiest grandma in the world. You know, we just had the seventh one.
Seven? Holy smokes, man. Congratulations.
Well, we got 3 kids. You know, we're hoping that they're all happy and they've got enough. You know. Anyway, so next year or two, she may put another couple of those shows together. It's a lot of work, though, you know, because it's not like a big organized charity. We do it from one little room in our house, and she and my daughters live on the telephone, browbeating people, getting deals here, you know, free booze here, you know.
Sure.
Just to make it work. She should probably do something again in the future.
And that's all. If people want information about that, is that at sunflowerjam.com or is it?
The sunflowerjam.com, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
All donations kindly accepted.
Absolutely, man. 2 more questions, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate everything that just being here with you, and you've been so cool, so thank you. First question is, biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years, and how much of that has been intentional, and how much is just been a natural part of aging?
I don't see it myself, but the other guys in the band told me that after our dear friend John Lord departed the band and then died, I became more outgoing as far as doing stuff like this in the band. I was always happy to be at the back and let the other guys take care of it. So once that happened, I did start doing more interviews and being more involved with the public side of the band. So that it wasn't something I thought I had to do. It just sort of came by as a natural movement. As you know, John used to do a lot of that stuff. Then he wasn't there. And then he wasn't there at all. And I sort of took on the mantle of a lot of stuff he did. You know, so that was a big change.
Thank you. And the last question is, what's the most important lessons lesson that you think you've learned through either your business or just from living X number of years already that you would share with others?
Well, as you know, if you do become successful in this business, there's a lot of money involved, and it's the only industry I can think of, whether you're an actor, musician, you know, entertainment, where you do the work and somebody gets the money first.
Yeah.
You know, somebody gets the money, you know. I can never understand why that was so. Even with you could have the most trusted people working with you in the world, but I can't think of any other business where the person does the work, doesn't get the money, and then pay everybody else.
Yeah, you're right. Usually you get the money, you know? Then you pay everybody the expenses. And you know,
exactly.
This is what, you know, here's your fees, whatever. Yeah.
That's right. There's your percentage. You know, and that still drives me nuts. And I like to trust as many people as I can. Trust only goes so far. You know, you've got to be aware that a figure with lots of zeros behind it can change everybody's perception of reality. So, yeah.
Interesting.
Be aware.
Thank you,
be
man.
Be aware.
Listen, I can't tell you how happy I'm like, this is so, you made my day, man. You made my week. I'm so happy to talk with you, man. I have listened to you entertain me, and thank you so much for all the brilliant, lovely, wonderful music you've made over the last 50 years that I've been listening to. So I can't thank you enough. I wish you nothing but good health for you and your family. Enjoy all your grandkids. Let me wrap this up and then I'll say goodbye to you. Any other last messages you want to pass along?
Well, like everybody, let's hope we get through this screwed up year and we hopefully get a nice new start for next year. Because I can't see anything happening this year for anybody. It's just a matter of getting through it. But I also have a problem with all the governments of the world. They're all talking about a second wave, which we're going through here in some of the European countries. What are they going to do in 2 years' time if they're talking about the eighth, ninth wave? Sooner or later, you just got to shut the hell up, let the world get on with it, and let society take its chance.
Amen.
We're going to lose some people, but every time one of these things happen, whether it be the Black Death or the Spanish flu, we lose some people. But we as a race, as a species and a society, we get through it. And if we're not going to do that, we might as well give everybody a free gun, just say, finish it now. Because we have to let it go.
Thank you. I agree with you. Because people are dying economic deaths instead of physical. I mean, you got to get people back to work, man. You got to get people moving. I agree with you.
You got to let nature take its course and everybody take their chance. You hope it's not you or yours who get affected, but we can't just stop society like this. Just can't do it.
It's
become pointless being here.
You want to run for president here, you got a good shot of winning, let me tell you. Hang on one second. Let me wrap this up. Thank you.
Sure.
Everybody, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this, please share it around on your social media channels. Thanks very much to Ian Pace for everything, for a lifetime of great music and great memories. And most important, especially nowadays, man, remember that happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar or your drums, and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I am out. Brother, thank you so much, Ian.
Pleasure, man. Bye.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Everyone Loves Guitar. If you did, make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com/subscribe and subscribe to the audio podcast and to our very active YouTube community. And if you have any comments, please write me at everyonelovesguitar.com/hello. We'll see you on the next episode. Until then, make sure you choose happiness. Relax and have as much fun as possible.
Whether you're looking to build a website for your business, your hobby, your podcast, or just for fun, Pear Networks is your go-to web hosting partner. Not only do we have the lowest domain price in the industry, starting at just $11, we've got hundreds of stunning website templates to help you stand out from the crowd. You're not a techie? Not a problem. With our easy DIY site builders, you can launch your impressive website without any technical know-how. And when it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. Check out pear.com today to learn more. PAIR.com.